5. Has a sense of entitlement, i.e., unreasonable expectations of especially favorable treatment or automatic compliance with his or her expectations. 6. Is interpersonally exploitative, i.e., takes advantage of others to achieve his or her ends. 7. Lacks empathy. Is unwilling to recognize or identify with the feelings and needs of others. 8. Is often envious of others or believes that others are envious of him or her. 9. Shows arrogant, haughty behaviors or attitudes. The authors of the above passage had no idea they were writing about politics. They thought they were writing about mental illness. This perspective analysis of politicians appears on page 717 of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Medical Disorders, 4th edition, under the heading Diagnostic Criteria for Narcissistic Personality Disorder. The only thing in the shrink's notes that might seem odd to a voter is lack of empathy. Every politician is always telling us how much sympathy, understanding, and fellowship he or she has with us, and how deeply he or she is moved by our hopes, our dreams, and our fears. About such too muchness of protestation, Hamlet's mother, no mean politician herself, has an oft-quoted line. There is an enormously powerful machine that, with one wrong turn, can kill us all, and it's being run by crazy people. What are the chances this will turn out well? In the meantime, it's costing us a fortune. Milton and Rose Friedman, in their seminal work about liberty and market freedoms, Free to Choose, showed why government is so expensive. The Friedmans devised what in logic is called a truth table to show that there are, logically, only 4 categories of spending. The table is as follows. Category 1. Your money being spent on you. Category 2. Your money being spent on someone else. Category 3. Someone else's money being spent on you. Category 4. Someone else's money being spent on someone else. Footnote. Seminal is such a PBS word, as close as PBS comes to talking dirty, and Free to Choose was indeed a companion piece to a 1980 PBS special by the same name. The dirt in this case could be heard thumping on the lid of the Carter presidency's coffin. Jimmy Carter must have realized that when, as a liberal Democrat, even public broadcasting turns on you, you're dead as a smelt. End note. Category 1 is you spending your money on yourself. Let's take cars as an example of something to spend on, and me as an example of someone doing the spending. I have a splendid Porsche 911 that I got a great deal on, buying it almost new from a dentist who scared himself and bought a Lexus coupe instead. When you spend your money on yourself, you get, as nearly as you can, exactly what you want, and you bargain as hard as you can for it. In Category 2, when you're spending your money on someone else, you still bargain hard, but you're not quite as concerned about getting exactly what's wanted. Although I'm sure my wife is very fond of the Kia Rondo minivan I purchased for her and the kids. And it was a lucky break for me that it had been sitting on the dealer's lot for almost a year, because it is a somewhat unfortunate shade of orangey green. You spend someone else's money on yourself in Category 3. And I'm on the fence between the Aston Martin DBS coupe that goes for close to $300,000 and letting someone else off easy with an Alfa Romeo 8C Competizione Spider convertible, a steal at $230,000. With Category 4, you're not involved at all. It's not your money, and nothing's in it for you. So it might as well be billions spent on jack shit, or, as the government called it, cash for clunkers. There is only one problem with the above examples from the Friedman's truth table. The Friedmans assume that the person doing the 4 categories of spending is not an insane evil pig. Can that assumption be made about me if I'm a politician? Things don't look good even in Category 1. That 9/11 is a relic of my footloose bachelor days. I've had it for 20 years and could never afford another one, unless I plunder the children's college fund. For Category 2, I'll stick with the orangey-green Kia. My wife had a couple glasses of wine last night, and it turns out she hates it. I mean, hates it. In Category 3, I'm pulling out the stops with the $2 million Bugatti Veyron, the fastest production car in the world, and a $500,000 Maybach 62 that has plenty of room in the back for all the booze, drugs, and strippers that someone else's money can buy. But it's Category 4, the category into which all government spending falls, where crazy, malicious hoggishness can be given full play. If I'm buying a car for you peons, it may not be enough for me to just throw money away on something you don't want. I may have other thoughts. Maybe I think I prefer a world that isn't full of smelly pollution, and where I don't have to worry about the temperature getting so high that I'll be able to bake bread by leaving dough outdoors on an August day in Nome. So your car has to be an even more unfortunate shade of green than my wife's Kia. Plus, I don't like being stuck in traffic or constantly looking for parking places. So your car not only shouldn't emit greenhouse gases, it shouldn't do anything else. Plus, don't forget I hate your guts because I'm an insane evil pig. Thus, no research, development, or manufacturing expense will be spared to provide each one of you with a hybrid Yugo. There are very few excuses for allowing goods and services to be allocated by political means unless you're trying to get something that isn't yours. And what you get is a Yugo. That's one Yugo for you versus innumerable reasons for the rest of us to prevent you from allocating goods and services by political means. Make that innumerable plus three. One, concentrated benefits and diffuse costs. Two, invisible opportunities. Three, committee brain. One of the things that allows us to be eaten up by our politics is that we are eaten very slowly, one political bug bite at a time. If we were being eaten by a boa constrictor or Kim Jong-il, we'd notice. But in a democracy, it takes years for us to wake up and say, as Ronald Reagan so memorably said in the 1942 movie King's Row, "Where's the rest of me?" Not until almost 40 years later, when Reagan was running for president, did we taxpayers finally come to our senses and ask the same question about our paychecks. The first secret of our obliviousness to being swallowed is what's called diffuse costs. A government idiocy may be expensive, but the expense is spread so broadly that none of us feels the nip of that expense very hard. For instance, let's take a government idiocy that's quite expensive and, furthermore, obviously and evidently useless to the nation and which doesn't have any political support. Joe Biden. Joe Biden costs us $227,300 a year in salary plus $90,000 for official entertainment expenses. O'Doul's, because somebody has to keep a clear head during those White House beer summits. Then there are the tens of thousands spent on around-the-clock White House staffers trying to keep Joe Biden's mouth shut, and more tens of thousands for shoe shines, black neckties, and Air Force Two fuel when unimportant foreign leaders die, and at least $20 worth of Secret Service protection. We'll round it off and take a guess and say that Joe Biden costs us $600,000 a year. But there are 300 million of us. Yes, Joe is a complete waste of 0.2%, but who cares? Joe does. That is the concentrated benefits part of concentrated benefits and diffuse costs. The 0.2% means nothing to us, but it's everything in the world to Joe Biden, who will bear any burden, meet any hardship, pay any price. Well, no, we'll pay the price. Even go on Bill O'Reilly to remain 1.5 heartbeats from the presidency. The half a heartbeat is the time it will take Nancy Pelosi to wring his neck and become president herself. And so it goes with other government idiocies even more expensive than Joe, such as AIG and Homeland Security. The expense of politics wouldn't matter so much if it weren't for the opportunities that are destroyed by this spending. Money that's poured down rat holes can't be used to pay the Pied Piper. Not that the government of Hamlintown did pay the Pied Piper. These destroyed opportunities, or opportunity costs, as economists call them, are the flip side of zero sum. It is a source of wickedness to believe that the world contains a fixed amount of resources. Paradoxically, it is a source of wickedness to forget that the world does contain a fixed amount of resources at any given moment. The amount of resources is infinitely expandable, but in order to expand it, we have to spend the resources we currently have on something other than Joe Biden. Because our opportunities are lost, so lost they never got anywhere near us, it's easy and maybe comforting to forget about them. These opportunities are certainly invisible to politicians. They don't see the businesses that weren't started, the innovations that weren't pursued, the charitable donations that weren't made, and the beer I didn't drink because a jerk professor and a college town cop, talk about a fight I don't have a dog in, drank it in the White House backyard. Meanwhile, politicians work themselves into a lather of rationalization about the benefits of government spending. In this, they are aided by the more vile kinds of economists, such as Paul Krugman and the late John Kenneth Galbraith. Using liberal political economic reasoning, I can prove anything. I can prove that shooting convenience store clerks stimulates the economy. Jobs are created in the high-paying domestic manufacturing sector at gun and ammunition factories. Additional emergency medical technicians, security guards, healthcare providers, and morticians are hired. The unemployment rate is lowered as job seekers fill new openings on convenience store night shifts. And money stolen from convenience store cash registers stimulates the economy where stimulus is most needed, in low-income neighborhoods where the people who shoot convenience store clerks go to buy their crack. I am simply flabbergasted that the Democratic majority in the House and Senate isn't smoking crack and shooting convenience store clerks this very minute, considering all the good it does. And where are the missing opportunities? There were some convenience store clerks who thought they were going to have an opportunity to do something, if only grab a smoke outside the back door on their break. But they're dead. The expense of politics is bad. The political destruction of opportunities is very bad. But nothing is as dreadful as the brain of a politician. Ha ha ha, what brain? Alas, it's worse than a joke. Taken one by one, politicians are of dull, normal intelligence. They're not Stephen Hawking, but they're not Mark Sanford either, except Mark Sanford. But when you put politicians together in governments, you get committees. In Congress, they even come right out and call the committees committees. We've all been on committees. We know what happens to intelligence and common sense when a person becomes a committee member. Committee brain. You live in a neighborhood with a playground. The kids in the neighborhood would like to play tetherball, but the playground has no tetherball pole. A committee is formed to raise funds for tetherball. Committee to Raise Funds for Tetherball, CRFT. CRFT is started by a group of pleasant, enthusiastic, public-spirited neighbors. The minute any of these neighbors becomes a member of CRFT, he or she will begin to express his or her pleasant, enthusiastic public spirit by turning into one of the following. The fanatic. Everyone loves tetherball. Everyone will donate to CRFT. There are a lot of rich people in the neighborhood. They'll all donate. Let's set our fundraising goal at $1 million. I'll throw in, prolonged giggling, $5 to get the ball rolling. The martinet. We have to draw up a charter and form a non-profit corporation with a chairman, a president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, development officer, human resources executive, 4 calling birds, 3 French hens, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge on a tetherball pole exactly 10 feet high. We're talking about regulation tetherball played according to North American Amateur Tetherball Association rules. The dog in the manger. We need to get permission from the county zoning board, the city council, the parks department, and adjacent landowners who may complain about tetherball noise. That part of the playground is too damp for tetherball. It might be federally protected wetlands. We can't do any fundraising without advertising. We can't advertise without raising funds. The kids would rather have a tennis court. The person who was stupid even by committee brain standards. So, the rope, like, has a ball on it? The worrier. Padded pole, breakaway tether, a lightweight foam ball, and ban on playing after dark or when visibility is poor and when the sun is shining to avoid UV ray skin cancer damage. The kid should wear helmets and knee pads and safety belts. The person with ideas. If we call ourselves the Committee to Raise American Funds for Tetherball, yeah, we can use the acronym CRAFTY. Let's set up a challenge grant to erect a second tetherball pole in the inner city. Midnight tetherball could be an alternative to crime for deprived youth. We can also promote tetherball as a way to combat child obesity, which would make us eligible for funding from United Way. And we should also apply to the Gates Foundation. Or invent a tetherball cell phone app and rake in the cash. We'll have a tetherball league. No, three. Adults, juniors, and tether tots. This could be a great Title IX thing. If our daughters are varsity-level tetherball players, they'll get into Yale. I'll go on the internet and check out tetherball coaching. I'll bet the best coaches come from Eastern Europe. We could probably hire the top coach in Bucharest for peanuts if we get him a green card. And from there, it's straight to the Olympics. The person with ideas, none of which has anything to do with tetherball. Is tetherball biodegradable? Is the pole made from recycled materials? Many playground balls are manufactured in third world countries using exploitative child labor. Let's be sure to utilize organic fertilizer and indigenous plant species when seeding the tetherball play area. Power mowers will contribute to climate change. The bossy person, who says the same thing as everyone else on the committee, but louder. The person who won't shut up, who says the same thing as everyone else on the committee, but more often. The person who won't show up, unless his or her vote is crucial, in which case he or she shows up and votes the wrong way. You. You actually do all the work and call 40 people and ask them each to donate $10, and half of them do, and you raise the $200 needed, only to find out you need $200,000, because the House of Representatives Economic and Educational Opportunities Committee's Select Committee on Opportunities in Physical Education's Subcommittee on Americans with Disabilities Act Compliance has delivered a report to the House/Senate Joint Economic Committee, which has referred legislation to House and Senate conference committees to reconcile a bill requiring all tetherballs to be wheelchair accessible no matter how high the tetherballs fly in the air. Given the complete dominance of politics by committee brain, the wonder is that anything gets done. And the horror is that it does. What government accomplishes is what you'd expect from a committee. A camel is a horse designed by a committee, is a saying that couldn't be more wrong. A camel is a seeing eye dog designed by a committee and available free with government grants to the halt and the lame. Yet committees are ancient and ubiquitous in our civilization. Moses goes to a business conference with God, and the next thing you know, Exodus 32:1. The people gathered themselves together. And someone says, all in favor of worshiping a golden calf? Same thing in the Roman Senate. All in favor of relinquishing power to Caesar, then stabbing him. And again in the boardrooms of Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and Fannie Mae. All in favor of investing in loans to people who made loans to people who made loans to people with houses that aren't worth pissing on if they catch fire. Committees persist, although their decisions are invariably stupid. Therefore, committees must provide some value to our civilization with their stupidity. And they do. In fact, it could be suggested that our freedoms find their surest protection in stupidity. We owe the thought to Lord Brougham, another of 19th-century Britain's great defenders of liberty. As a member of Parliament, Brougham carried the bill to make slave trading a felony in 1810 and was instrumental in passing the Reform Bill of 1832 that widely expanded the electorate and made seats in Parliament more nearly representational. Brougham, who incidentally had a style of fancy carriage named after him, set the fashion for going to the Riviera and became himself quite stupid later in life. Said, all we see about us, kings, lords, and commons, the whole machinery of the state, all the apparatus of the system, and its varied workings, end in simply bringing 12 good men into a box. In other words, what makes and keeps us free is a committee, the jury. Governments have the legal monopoly on deadly force, and in a free country, the thing that prevents the government from forcing us into prison or onto the lethal injection gurney any time it likes is the need for a jury verdict. Our government cannot inflict any punishment or penalty upon us unless what we have done is so obviously wrong and outrageously bad that even a feeble-minded, asinine, obtuse, muddled, stubborn, and silly committee, which never agrees on anything, agrees. Stupidity is our unwavering safeguard, and one that, it is to be hoped, will protect Joe Biden when he is arrested for shooting convenience store clerks. 7. Morality in politics, and what's it doing in there? Morality is important to politics. Important is not the same as necessary. You can remove morality from politics like you can remove the head from a chicken, and they'll both keep going. Politics much longer than the chicken. Politics will continue to run around, flap, and spurt blood forever without its morality. What's important about morality in politics is us. We own the chicken farm. We must give our bird-brained, feather-headed politicians morals. Politicians love to think of themselves as free range, but they do not have the capacity to hunt or gather morals in the wild. If we fail to supply them with morality, politicians begin to act very scary in the barnyard. These are enormous headless chickens, and they have nukes. But while we all say it would be good if politicians were moral, we all get a little nervous when morality in politics is advocated. We worry about the separation of church and state. We are afraid that morality is the thick end of whatever is the opposite of a wedge, and that this tool will be used to knock church and state back together with a bang that will result in, at best, the Taliban and the Spanish Inquisition, if not Sarah Palin. None of these is a good idea. Yet separation of church and state is a problem that's well addressed by the First Amendment. We should be demanding separation of state and coven. Maybe politics is inherently evil. Maybe politics is so evil that anything we do for it, even attempting to supply it with morality, just feeds the beast. I trust this isn't true, but I can't say the thought doesn't trouble me. The sum and substance of politics was expressed in the 1860s by prescient Russian radical Nikolai Chernyshevsky. Man is God to man. The faith of politics is in the holy goodness and correctness of mankind, as soon as humanity gets politically corrected, and in the collective mystical solidarity of that reformed mankind. These impious sentiments were nicely put by the poetic genius and political idiot Percy Bysshe Shelley. Man, one harmonious soul of many a soul, whose nature is his own divine control. Making man divine does take some doing. But there have been numerous volunteers for the task, starting predictably with a French philosopher. Claude-Adrien Helvetius, 1715-71, made the awful pronouncement that it is only by good laws that we can form virtuous minds. This notion was taken up with enthusiasm by Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto. You must therefore confess that by individual you mean no other person than the bourgeois. This person must indeed be swept out of the way and made impossible. Then the idea was put into force by the likes of Leon Trotsky, who, writing in 1924, sounds more full of romantic crap than Shelley. Man will become incomparably stronger, wiser, subtler. His body will become more harmonious, his movements more rhythmic, his voice more melodious. If he lives. Thus the virtuous new man, imagined by politics, comes to rule over heaven and earth. Call him Ben, or call him Jerry. He rewrites Genesis so that Adam loses all of his ribs and half his backbone to ensure that the Garden of Eden is fully representative of the spectrum of human sexuality. Endangered species go first into the ark. Now, how do we get those brontosaurs out of the vegetable garden? Moses is called to the mountaintop to receive the 10,000 nice ideas, urging the Israelites to be in touch with their feelings, and deploring speech that's hurtful and divisive. Joshua blows his horn, and the residents of Jericho join in on recorders and tambourines. There's no capital punishment in the Judea of Pontius Pilate. Jesus does 3 to 5 in imperial minimum security. He writes the Gospel of Prison Reform and starts a socially conscious, sustainable small business by using his heavenly powers to invent refrigeration. The symbol of universal salvation is ice cream. We are blessed with an infinite number of cleverly named delicious flavors. But we are required by law to use someone else's tongue to lick them. Politics violates not only the first commandment about who's God, it violates the other 9 as well. Politics could hardly function without bearing false witness. Likewise, without taking the Lord's name in vain. The more so given that in politics the Lord who is so loosely sworn by is you and me, mankind. In modern government, politics has taken the place of mere tyranny. The result has been more killing in the past century than in all the preceding centuries combined. Covetousness and stealing define redistributive politics, and without redistribution, politics would have no political support. And graven image is as good a way as any to describe the fiat money by which redistributive politics operates. Politics' insistence upon involvement in every human activity, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is more anti-Sabbatarian than golf. The Social Security system is no way to honor thy father and mother. As for adultery, there was, and there may still be, Bill Clinton. Even to be politically engaged and informed may make us one of the devil's party, driving around town with a Vote Satan bumper sticker. Listen carefully to that most politically engaged and informed radio network, NPR, and hear the evident relish with which it reports misfortune, inequity, and suffering around the world. The unspoken gleeful message is, more occasions for more politics. Nor are conservatives without delight in others' misery. How we long for unemployment, anxiety, anger, and fear of bombs in boxer shorts on the next election day. I believe in original sin, and politics may be its name. However, unlike some of my fellow Republicans, I do not believe God is involved in politics. Observe politics in America. Observe politics around the world. Observe politics down through history. Does it look like God is involved? When it comes to being a political activist, that would be the other fellow. This said, unless we intend to climb the pillar of Simeon Stylites and evict Simeon or go off the grid with a one-man militia in the Bitterroot Range, or otherwise isolate ourselves from every arrangement among persons, even the Dalai Lama hasn't been able to manage it, we need another way to approach morality in politics. Morality is a larger sphere than politics, thank goodness, literally. The relationship between things that are moral and things that are political can be shown with Venn diagrams. This is a method invented by British logician John Venn to illustrate the categorical propositions of logic. Footnote. If Professor Venn had had any idea how his diagrams would be used in PowerPoint presentations, he would have shot himself, but not before tracking down Professor Pi, inventor of the pie chart, and shooting him first. End note. Here is an example of a Venn diagram of the categorical proposition known as universal negative. Two independent circles, one with Simon Cowell written in the center, the other with people you'd invite to your child's piano recital written in its center. And here is a Venn diagram of politics and morality illustrating the categorical proposition known as particular affirmative, which can otherwise be stated as most politicians will burn in hell. One circle, labeled politics, with politicians who burn in hell written in the center, overlapping with a second circle labeled morality, with good people written in the center, and the area where the two overlap, including moral political behavior. If the circle of politicians fell completely within the circle of morality, none of us bitchmongers in the media would have a job. Fat chance of that. Even if a miracle happened and politicians and voters became saints, there are aspects of politics that fall outside morality. There's no perfectly ethical way to conduct taxation or utterly good method of exercising public domain. Some injustice in letting the guilty out of jail must be preferred in our legal system to the greater injustice of jailing me. Then there's war. The reasons for a war may be highly principled. The conduct of a war cannot be. And religion doesn't work. Even the most religious among us shouldn't get ourselves so sanctimoniously confused that we think religion and morality are identical. It's not a one-circle Venn diagram. Imagine one circle, labeled religion, with Pat Robertson on the subject of Haiti, bombs in boxer shorts, and throwing virgins into volcanoes written in the center, overlapping with a circle labeled morality, with being good when God isn't looking in the center, with what would Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, or anyway, Bono do, written in the overlapping area between the two. The most important part of politics in a free country, the law, falls mostly into the category of being good while God isn't looking. God is love, and the law won't even cuddle. The fact that law can't be made identical to morality is not just a matter of the legal impracticalities in punishing all moral lapses. You can make me share, but you can't make me care. In a democracy, the law must be exact, so we know exactly whether we're obeying it and exactly how to change it if we don't feel like obeying. Love is not as exacting as law. Even our mothers wouldn't love us if it were. But they do. Mom's fond trait, and we'll put her in the nursing home anyway, stems from the same root as all morality, from the Old Testament love, when the Lord saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Even the bugs. From the graciousness of the Buddha, whose first precept was, not to kill, to have regard for life, human, animal, and vegetable, not to destroy carelessly. Not to ride our bikes across the lawn of our mean, crazy neighbor, Mr. Norbert. From the mercy of Christ, who told us to love thy neighbor as thyself. Never mind that Mr. Norbert is chasing us with a rake. And from the opening words of the Quran, which have nothing to do with wiping Israel off the face of the map, something the Romans had done already in 70 A.D., but say, in the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Love, grace, and mercy are absolute. Law is the opposite. And not because law is hateful, clumsy, and unkind, all of the time. Human laws are the reverse of the laws of the infinite because our laws are arbitrary. They need to be. For example, sooner or later, we need to declare people to be legally dead. It would be interesting if we could see the soul depart, perhaps on gossamer wings, looking a bit like The Rock in his tutu in the movie Tooth Fairy, or in different garb, plunging down the sewer grate in smoke and flames. But we have only human knowledge, so we must rely on things like heartbeat or brain waves, or whether the dead guy's kids have finished divvying up his truck, Tampa timeshare, and ski-doo. And when does life begin legally? Right to Life activists claim they know. But what if the soul is in the egg, and we have to arrest every ovulating woman who failed to get laid? What if it's in the sperm, and every adolescent boy has to be tried on 100 million counts of manslaughter? In regard to this question, the U.S. Congress says, to put it in parliamentary terms, dunno. But law courts need to decide. Somebody, whether he's the size of a pinhead or has been in a coma since Spiro Agnew resigned, owns that truck, Tampa timeshare, and ski-doo. It's the law. The problem with human lawmaking is that we fail to remember we're only human, and some of our lawmakers can barely claim that. We sometimes make laws that are moral to the best of our knowledge, but we always forget that the best of our knowledge is worth squat. Easy examples of this hubris abound. For my sins, I'll take a hard one. Human embryo stem cell research. People who know more about medicine than I do, which is everyone who knows anything about it, say that such research is valuable. I'll stipulate its value. People who know more about my religion than I do, such as the Pope, oppose it. I'm not going to argue Catholicism with Benedict XVI. I'm given to understand that the frozen human embryos upon whom the research will be conducted are leftovers, but as a male of 63, the same can be said about me. The embryos will not develop into adults capable of being doctors and popes. Neither will I. But I've had chickenpox, measles, scarlet fever, and cancer. I'm alive because of medical research, much of which seemed morally dubious when it was begun. My own deep philosophical thinking about frozen human embryo stem cell research goes no further than that the whole idea of frozen human embryos, let alone what's done to them with tweezers, creeps me out. I'm happy, this is one of the consolations of advancing age, that I don't have to make the decision. Still, I was furious when the President of the United States made the decision for me. On March 9, 2009, the President signed an executive order rescinding the previous President's executive order that banned federal funding for human embryo stem cell research. Whether such research is wrong is something I will leave to the judgment of those who have better morals than I have. My morals are sufficient, however, for determining that President Obama was damn wrong. The White House Office of the Press Secretary released a statement titled Remarks of President Barack Obama as Prepared for Delivery, Signing of Stem Cell Executive Order and Scientific Integrity Presidential Memorandum. Herein was a perfect display of political immorality. The President said, "The full promise of stem cell research remains unknown, and it should not be overstated." He then overstated it. To regenerate a severed spinal cord and lift someone from a wheelchair, to spur insulin production and spare a child from a lifetime of needles, to treat Parkinson's, cancer, heart disease, and others that afflict millions of Americans and the people who love them. And note the politically astute touch of modern morality at the end. My dad's sick, my kid's hurting, but let's not make it all about them. I'm worried and hassled, too. Medical miracles do not happen simply by accident, the President went on to say. They result from painstaking and costly research, from years of lonely trial and error, much of which never bears fruit, and from a government willing to support that work. Thus it was that without King George's courtiers winding kite string for Ben Franklin and splitting firewood and flipping eye charts to advance his painstaking and costly research into lightning, stoves, and bifocals, Ben's years of lonely trial and error never did bear fruit. Today we think that the bright flash in a summer sky is God with static cling on his socks. We heat our homes by burning piles of pithy, plagiarized sayings from Poor Richard's Almanac in the middle of the floor, and we stare at our knitting through the bottom of old Coke bottles. We'd probably have telephones and light bulbs by now if President Rutherford B. Hayes, a Republican, had been willing to support the work of Alexander Graham Bell and Thomas Edison. As President Obama said, when governments fail to make these investments, opportunities are missed. Although the light bulbs would have to be replaced by dim, flickering fluorescent devices anyway to combat global climate change. At no point did the President acknowledge that these government investments are made with our money, or that that money can be taken from us and given to people doing research on human embryos only because the government has the legal monopoly on deadly force. Pay your taxes or get fined. Pay the fine or go to jail. Stay in jail or get shot trying to escape and join the Tea Party movement. We have a legislative mechanism by which the monopoly is supposed to be controlled. It's called legislation. If the people of our country absolutely insist on paying the bill for frozen human embryos to be pulled apart with tweezers, Congress can pass a law. Where exactly in the Constitution is this moral power over our money handed off to an executive order? No doubt the same criticism could be made of George W. Bush's executive order forbidding our money to be spent on human embryo stem cell research. But, speaking for myself, I don't get as constitutionally riled at presidents who leave my billfold alone. Instead of addressing any of these moral concerns, President Obama said, "Many thoughtful and decent people are conflicted about or strongly oppose this research." Then he called himself a liar. "The majority of Americans from across the political spectrum and of all backgrounds and beliefs have come to a consensus that we should pursue this research. Italics, added by someone from a Republican pro-life Catholic background. But the most morally offensive thing the president said in his signing remarks was that, in recent years, when it comes to stem cell research, rather than furthering discovery, our government has forced what I believe is a false choice between sound science and moral values. A false choice is no choice at all. Tweedledee / Tweedledum, Nancy Pelosi / Harry Reid, Joe Biden / Joe Biden. Science is, per Webster's Third International Dictionary, Definition 1, possession of knowledge as distinguished from ignorance or misunderstanding. Let us look at the various things science has known in the past 3,000 years. Thunder is the fart of Thor. The periodic table consists of earth, wind, and fire, and a recording of Got to Get You Into My Life. The world is flat, with signs near the edges saying, Here be Democrats. You can turn lead into gold without a federal bailout. We are the center of the universe, and the sun revolves around us, and shines out of Uranus, Mr. President, if I may be allowed a moment of utter sophomoricism. But lest anyone think that this teasing of science lacks moral gravitas, let us consult, and be appalled by, the following passages from the 1910 to 1111 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, that great compendium of all the knowledge science possessed, carefully distinguished from ignorance and misunderstanding, as of 100 years ago. The Negro would appear to stand on a lower evolutionary plane than the white man, and to be more closely related to the highest anthropoids. Mentally, the Negro is inferior to the white. After puberty, sexual matters take the first place in the Negro's life and thought. The above are quoted, not out of context, from the article titled Negro, written by Dr. Walter Francis Wilcox, professor of social science and statistics at Cornell and chief statistician of the U.S. Census Bureau. A politician. Politicians shouldn't be allowed to make any moral decisions. They shouldn't be allowed to decide whether to shit or go blind, a decision that might be morally painful for a politician if he isn't polling well with the shits. 8. Taxes. Taxes are a good thing. Every tax, said Adam Smith, is to the person who pays it a badge, not of slavery, but of liberty. It denotes that he is subject to government indeed, but that, as he has some property, he cannot himself be the property of a master. We are tempted to answer Smith with the "We don't need no stinking badges" quote from the movie Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but the sage of economic freedom has a point. We cannot be expected to surrender rights in our property, that is, pay taxes, unless we are understood to have property rights, and chief among property rights is our right to the property of ourselves. We are free. Even when taxes are levied by force, first they have to catch us. Also, taxes caused democracy. When England's Charles I had to go, crown in hand, to beg Parliament for tax revenues, an elected body was able to claim sovereignty and dispatch with the divine right of kings, and King Charles's head. Our own Revolutionary War was precipitated by taxes. No taxation without representation was a slogan among the American patriots, a crowd of whom would protest such taxes at the Boston Tea Party in 1773. And the original Tea Partiers, like their later-day namesakes, were regarded with contempt by well-placed know-it-alls. Peter Oliver, Chief Justice of Massachusetts, said of Samuel Adams, "He never failed of employing his abilities to the vilest purposes." The French Revolution, too, was a result of taxes. Louis XVI needed to raise them, and, looking to do so, convened the States General, a group of delegates from the nobility, the clergy, and the commoners. A cutthroat bunch they proved to be. We owe a lot to our taxes, but we owe a lot on our taxes, too. That is why the most surprisingly good thing about taxes is that they are a good deal. The American government will spend $4 trillion this year. There are an estimated 308.6 million Americans. We each get $12,956. Sure, we mostly get it in the form of Sacramento light rail projects that don't go anywhere except Sacramento, sugar beet price supports, contributions to the charity known as GM, Afghanistan troop surges, and interest payments on Chinese-owned T-bills. We'd rather have cash. But still, $12,956 isn't bad. Let's say you're a family of five, a dad, a mom, and three lovely kids. You're the kind of family we conservatives endorse. You're getting $64,781 from the government. Even Republicans are on the dole. Dad, conservative women are proud to be stay-at-home moms, will have to make a pile of money to pay $65,000 in taxes. Although it is unclear just how big a pile Dad will have to make to ensure that he's feeding, sheltering, and grooming the America of the future rather than sucking her teat. Democrats in Congress may lower taxes for fear that more Republicans will be elected. Or Democrats in Congress may raise taxes for fear more Republicans will be elected before Democrats have a chance to enact a tax hike. The president may make all Wall Street profits greater than the 2009 Madoff investor average return subject to punitive capitation. Or the president may give another squillion-jillion dollars in bailout funds to all Wall Street firms. The tax code is so confusing that every time a federal appointment is made, the appointee has to go before a congressional committee to explain how he got so confused that he didn't pay his taxes. And taxes, and loans to government that will have to be repaid with taxes, come in a variety of types and kinds. Personal income tax receipts fund less than a quarter of federal outlays. Corporate taxes provide a whopping 3.8%. Borrowed money accounts for nearly half of what Washington will spend this year. The deficit gap will be closed by revenue from that $9 pack of cigarettes you just bought because thinking about taxes stresses you out. Natasha Altamirano of the National Taxpayers Union did some complicated mathematics and said, "By my reckoning, somewhere between 85 and 95 million households out of 115 million total have a smaller tax liability than the per capita spending burden. This means that the breadwinners for between one-fifth and one-quarter of American households are shoveling coal in the engine rooms of the ship of state, while everybody else is a stowaway necking with Kate Winslet like Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic." Miss Altamirano went on to note that those breadwinners doing all the work are also less likely to be receiving any kind of government monetary assistance and are more likely to have their Social Security benefits taxed. "If we were to compensate for this," she said, "I imagine that more like 100 million households have a smaller liability than the per capita spending burden. 100 out of 115 is 87%. Our nation is 87% mooch, 87% leech, 87% spare, hope, and change, man." It may be worse than that, or, depending on how greedily liberal you are, better. Let's abandon the complicated mathematics of taxation. We don't understand complicated mathematics. We were liberal arts majors. If we understood complicated mathematics, we'd be wealthy hedge fund managers in prison. Let's go to arithmetic. The U.S. gross domestic product for 2009 has been calculated by the Department of Commerce's Bureau of Economic Analysis as $14.2 trillion. The federal budget, being $4 trillion, is, divide 4 by 14.2, move the decimal point two places to the right, add the thingy over the numeral 5 on your keyboard, 28.2% of the gross domestic product. Let's round down and call it 1/4. This is our real rate of national taxation. The government makes off with 1/4 of our goods and services. Then the government gives those goods and services back to us, in a slightly altered form, the way a horse gives the hay we feed it back to us in a slightly altered form. We each get our $12,956, which is our per-person share of 1/4 of the gross domestic product. But since the real tax rate on that GDP is 25%, each of us has to make $51,824 a year, our per-person share of the GDP, to be entitled to call ourselves a taxpayer, not a tax vampire. And we have to make $259,120 a year if we're supporting a family of five. Slightly confused by this? Democrats always have been. How many American households make a quarter of $1 million? The president's does, and with only two kids. The president is taxing himself. Good. But the rest of the U.S. government's operating expenses are being funded by paycheck withholding on Conan O'Brien's NBC settlement. Plus, there's all the money the government has borrowed by taking out a second mortgage on North America, which will soon have the Treasury Department calling the toll-free number for the debt restructuring services advertised on late-night TV. The gross unfairness of America's tax system won't lead to class war. Or, if it does, the war will be brief. There are 300 million of us SpongeBobs and hardly any of the suckerfish we're soaking. On the other hand, young people, with no dependents except their Twitter pals, have to earn only double their age to be ladling gravy to Uncle Sam. They could turn on the government if they started thinking about this, or anything. The rest of us? We're in the clover. True, we have to give 25% of our work week to the IRS. That's 10 hours, all of Wednesday and half of Thursday morning. But it's still a good deal and doesn't really leave us overburdened on the job. Nothing gets done on Monday and Friday anyway. Tuesday, we had to go pick up our kid from school because a peanut was discovered in the food dish belonging to the fifth grade's gerbil and the whole building had to be hypoallergized. On Thursday, after an early lunch, we left a full cup of coffee in our cubicle and draped our suit jacket over the back of our chair so it would look like we were around the office someplace and caught a Nationals game. We don't have to worry that out-of-control federal spending or an insane tax structure will wreck our lives. We've got government jobs. 9. More taxes. I take it back. Taxes aren't a good thing. This is because, as I mentioned before but forgot this time, you're very rich. You're surprised to learn that you're very rich, especially when, like me, you're really broke. But if you think about it, you know you're rich because only a rich person can afford to pay double for everything. And you do. The financial bailout, for example. You paid for it once when you discovered that your retirement savings consisted of nothing but half a chocolate bunny from last Easter, three paper clips, and a dried-up Sharpie. Then you paid for it again with your tax dollars and with the permanent damage done to the American economy when the government pawned everything in the nation because your tax dollars weren't enough to pay for the bailout. Likewise with the economic stimulus. You write checks to cover your mortgage payment, utilities, insurance premiums, car loan, basic cable, Visa, MasterCard, and American Express bills, and you hand fistfuls of cash to your children and turn them loose in the Abercrombie & Fitch store. Think you're done stimulating the economy? Think again. The President of the United States is also on an economically stimulating spending spree, and he's paying for it with a lien on all the future job and business opportunities that your children will have. This means they won't have them. I hope that your kids, once they've gotten their MBAs, enjoy stocking shelves at the dollar store. What about the new car you paid for with taxpayer funds given to GM and Chrysler? How come it isn't in the driveway? You gave all that money to the car companies, and they didn't even send a thank-you note on a scratch-and-sniff card with that new car smell. No, if you want a new car, you have to, you guessed it, pay double. Of course, maybe you got something out of the Cash for Clunkers program, and good for you if you did. At least when you bought a new car, you didn't pay GM or Chrysler twice. You paid Nissan once. Meanwhile, will some liberal brain box explain to me why it's a good thing to junk a useful machine? How does destroying something that's worth money make us worth more money? Paying double for everything didn't start with the financial crisis or even with Democratic control of Congress. Paying double is an integral part of the modern welfare state, beginning with welfare. Your tax dollars pay for federal, state, and local welfare programs. Then you pay for your daughter to pursue a career in holistic dance liberation. You subsidize your son's internet startup idea, Buttbook, a website you go on with all your enemies. Plus there's your perennial bum of a brother-in-law, tweaking on meth in the double-wide and watching Cartoon Network on the high-definition television you paid for. Same with schools. Your school taxes pay for Alger Hiss Public High School, conveniently right down the street, inconveniently full of heroin and 9mm handguns. So you also pay tuition at Friar Torquemada Parochial High. At school, home, or work, the most important function of government is to protect your person and property. That's what the police department is for. And you get to pay the police and pay for burglar alarms, private security patrols, and guard dogs, such as our family's guard dog, Pinky Wink. For the information of any prospective burglars, Pinky Wink isn't really a Boston Terrier. He's, a Rhodesian Ridgeback weighing 150 pounds. The kids named him. Stop yapping, Pinky Wink. The second most important function of government, in my opinion, is trash pickup. And people in government can start with themselves, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, municipal garbage collectors pick up the trash from your house. But not until you've sorted it into the proper recycling bins, which you do by picking up the trash from your house. With government, what you don't pay double for in money, you pay double for in time and effort. But usually it's money. When you pay a hospital bill, you're really paying two hospital bills. One bill for you because you have a job and or private insurance and can pay the hospital, and another bill, which is tacked onto your bill, to cover the medical expenses of someone who doesn't have a job and or private insurance and can't pay the hospital. Your tennis elbow underwrites the Alger Hiss Public High School student's 9mm handgun wound. And never is paying double as doubly troubling as it is in the matter of retirement. You have to pay into Social Security and into your IRA and your KEO plan and put some money in your savings account, too. You have to pay Medicare tax and buy Medicare supplemental insurance and contribute to a medical savings account and make doctor bill co-payments besides. And the funding for Social Security and Medicare is so underfinanced and actuarially shaky that you cannot be certain those programs will exist by the time you're eligible for them. And you're 64 and a half. Would you like to know what taxpayers are getting out of this deal? You and me both. How do we benefit from this twinning, this twoing, this duality? Damned if I can figure it out. Barkeep, make that a double. 10. Being penny wise. One thing that can be said in favor of our political system is that it doesn't change much or often, for better or for worse. The American government is a body of enormous mass, subject to considerable friction, but possessing tremendous momentum. This explains why we learned nothing in that high school civics class. If we wanted to understand government, we should have paid more attention to the high school physics class we flunked, or gotten a job on the railroad. Government is a mile of boxcars filled with lard. The locomotive is, at best, the little engine that could, and more often, something from Lionel. You and I are unlikely to get this train moving by pushing on the caboose, even if we get all our friends to help. But once it's in motion, we better not stand in its way. Derailment is an option if we pry up the tracks. What a mess. And this metaphor is making less sense than a physics lesson, especially if we take it into the switchyard of government planning. I'll try one more time. Government isn't the vehicle for lard. Government is the lard ass itself, waddling slowly down the path of least resistance, changing course only when it has to because of social forest fire, public opinion mudslide, or the earthquake of war. No matter how much we wanted the government to change course, and no matter how much we approve of the new direction government has taken, we were better off without the catastrophe that made the government turn left or right. You may like the New Deal, but a worldwide depression with its various side effects, such as Hitler, was a high price to pay for WPA murals. I may like Ronald Reagan, but the Earth would be a happier planet if he hadn't been necessary. We applaud the outcome of the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement, but an alternative, less costly in blood and treasure, was to not treat black people like shit for 500 years. That our government can't be easily budged or deflected is beneficial to some extent.